The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The Taliban are parading through Kandahar with their spoils of war, tanks and weapons the U.S. left behind. A reinforced army, but the Taliban still have to figure out how to govern.
Members of the former government didn't help at all in the transition. They just upped and ran, right? And so there's a lot of expertise missing.
I'm Marco Werman, and British Columbia takes unusual steps to limit overdose deaths, like sending text alerts about tainted drugs.
Light green counterfeit Xanax bar tested positive for fentanyl. Check your drugs.
Now the Canadian province is taking another unprecedented move. And a three-month-long ban on Twitter in Nigeria hasn't just been annoying. It's bad for businesses and their patrons.
Since the ban, patronage has been low, like significantly low.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. Residents of Afghanistan's capital are struggling to come to grips with a new normal in their city. The Taliban is now in full control, and its fighters are on the streets of Kabul, directing traffic and patrolling neighborhoods. Food is in short supply, prices for basic goods have skyrocketed, and civil servants haven't been paid in months. For more, we reached out to LA Times Middle East Bureau Chief Nabi Boulos. He's been on the ground in Kabul. Nabi, what have you been seeing and hearing on the streets of the capital today?
Today, and this has been happening for a few days now, there are people waiting in front of the banks. And this is basically a harbinger of a looming financial crisis here, because the country is basically starved for dollars. I mean, it was supposed to be getting a shipment of dollars on the day that Kabul fell. And of course, because Kabul was taken over by the Taliban, that shipment was stopped. And what that means is with MoneyGram and Western Union, these remittances services also suspended so far. Banks are just basically not able to have enough dollars. And so people are limited in their withdrawals. And what that means is that you have very long lines in front of the banks, queues with people basically waiting for hours, really days almost, just be able to get some money from their account. And to be clear, I mean, there's about, I think, $9.5 billion, roughly speaking, in assets, and most of them are parked abroad. So, I mean, without them, you know, the currency is going to basically fail. Of course, at the same time, you have people, you know, wondering if the Taliban will actually fulfill their promises, you know, whether their gentle face that they've been showing for these last 2 weeks with all the media scrutiny is going to now change into something harsher. And there are indications that it might. I mean, just today it said that they're not going to be including people from the governments of the last two decades. This is bound to alienate a lot of people here. It's a tense time.
What about civil servants, the people who run the city? And I'm assuming there are women in that group. Are any of them going to their jobs?
Well, the women at this point are not coming back to their jobs, not yet anyway. And the Taliban have said that women are not supposed to come back until, you know, they can secure the area and sort of teach Taliban fighters or like the rank and file, you know, some manners and how to deal with women, right? So they've asked for some forbearance in this part. With that being said, you are seeing men return, of course. So, for example, the other day I was at the municipality here, and there was a new Taliban mayor now, and the former mayor, and he's one of the rare officials who didn't escape, he remained and was now working under this new Taliban mayor as a counselor of sorts. These are all changes now, right? And of course, you see also the Taliban in police stations. They've taken over all that stuff. So the security services have been displaced. Although you do see every now and then some members of the Afghan National Security Forces back in the day.
And Nabi, do you have any insight into how the former mayor, who was not Taliban, is now working with the Taliban mayor?
Well, I mean, he's in a subordinate role, to be clear, right? But they need his expertise. I mean, the fact is that the part of the reason why things are so kind of unstable at the moment is because members of the former government didn't help at all in the transition. They just upped and ran, right? And so there's a lot of expertise missing. He was one of the few who remained and actually is helping. And I mean, to be clear, you know, I think he's, I mean, this wasn't done because of any love for the Taliban per se, perhaps, I don't know. But it seems to me that he had remained more because someone had to, right? And try to keep matters going in Kabul.
Right. How are the Taliban presenting themselves generally to the residents of Kabul? Are they menacing or friendly? Or, I don't know, are any attempts to try and win people over? Or is it, we're in charge, pay attention?
No. I mean, they've been doing a huge PR offensive. You know, they're always saying that they want to be inclusive, that there's a general amnesty, that even President Ashraf Ghani, you know, is able to benefit from this amnesty. I mean, they're playing a good game in this regard, right? They're saying that their aim is reconciliation. So, for example, you know, they also had a meeting the other day with the national cricket team captain, just to show that they're not against sports, et cetera, et cetera. So all this is happening. But at the same time, today, right, they said they would be forming a government within 2 days. And more importantly, that, you know, people from the former U.S.-backed government couldn't participate. So that's the problem. That indicates a hardening of sorts that we didn't notice before, or that wasn't there before.
If that is the case with that amnesty, why are there still so many people who just don't trust the Taliban and really want to leave the country?
The gamble is with your life, essentially. Right? It's not a simple matter of, okay, let's wait and see, you know, and then it's great or it's not so great. It's pretty much, you know, great or essentially death, I think, for many people.
And what have you heard about how the Taliban is going about forming a new government and what that kind of worldview is going to be when they do?
There's been a lot of talk about Islamic law and how they will apply it. And this has been, you know, one of those sort of flexible, fuzzy concepts so far. And it's unclear how it's going to, you know, sort of actually play out in practice. Today, you also see them talking about, again, about reconciliation, right? They talk about having an inclusive government. They've been trying to focus on the issue of the economy as well, that they basically want to have, let's say, some stability and security, you know, as well as inclusive government, so they can attract aid, which funds 3/4 of the civil service. So these are some of the steps they're doing.
How have you been treated, Nabi? What dealings have you had with the Taliban so far?
Well, so, I mean, I should sort of stress, first of all, right, that I'm in a privileged position here. I mean, you know, I'm a foreign journalist. I have a Western passport. You know, I work for a Western organization. So for me, you know, the level of danger is different than it is for an Afghan journalist or for your normal Afghan on the street, right? And there's a much greater chance of accountability if something happens to me. Oh, and I should also add that I'm a man, so it's different as well. With all that being said, at the same time, we've been treated so far, I must say, without much trouble. I mean, my colleague Marcus Yam, you know, did have a run-in with some of the Taliban at some point before they knew that he was a foreign journalist, and then they stopped immediately, right? They had actually beaten him, and then, you know, they realized he was a foreign journalist and instantly stopped. You know, which is to say that we've been treated, I think, at some level with kid gloves. I'm not sure that's going to be the same for locals. And I don't know also how long that will last.
There is one video that's been circulating, and you are in it, walking into an airport hangar with Taliban fighters, I think yesterday, as they inspected Chinook helicopters parked inside. Can you tell us about that?
Basically, we were actually trying to catch a picture of the last C-17, of the last American C-17 flying out of the airport. Frankly, we were late. We missed the window. But what did happen was we were there to accompany the Taliban as they entered the airport. So we were basically walking with them as they were entering. And actually, you know, I realized later that those weren't Chinooks, but I believe Sea Knights, a smaller version thereof. And, you know, they were used by the U.S. Embassy officials to ferry themselves around and were sabotaged apparently before they left.
So you were not there for that dramatic moment when American General Chris Donahue stepped onto that C-17. But it sounds like, I mean, what you saw was equally compelling.
I mean, I think it was a summation of the war at some level of what had happened. You know, I mean, the withdrawal, the way it played out in the final hours as well, you know, all this was kind of a, you know, a microcosm, I guess, of the war effort itself and how things had changed. The Taliban were now, you know, back in control in full circle. It was really just fascinating to see, you know, them entering and examining the hardware, trying to figure out what they actually now had as their haul. I should also stress a lot of this stuff, you know, was innocuous. I mean, they had like piles of webbing, they had granola bars, they had MREs, but they also had bullets, M4s, M16s, various trucks. They did get, I mean, I did see some of them basically driving around with MRAPs. They might not have been the most recent American ones, but they were certainly not bad. And so they did get something.
LA Times Middle East Bureau Chief Nabi Boulos in Kabul. We really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
The U.S. no longer has troops on the ground in Afghanistan, so many experts expect drones to play a big role in how the U.S. handles potential threats from extremists like Al-Qaeda and ISIS-K, who are in Afghan territory. For some insight into how this will work, we turn now to Sarah Krebs. She's a national security expert and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. Sarah's in Washington. Over the weekend, in the chaos of the withdrawal, Sarah, the U.S. carried out a drone strike against what it said was an ISIS-K target, a car laden with explosives. What did that operation show us about what we think is going to be a new U.S. counter-terror strategy in Afghanistan?
Well, I think that what we're likely to see is continuation of those types of operations, but they're going to have to look quite a bit different in the sense that over the weekend, we still had troops and a U.S. military presence in Afghanistan. We no longer have that, and we don't have bases in the region. And so it appears as though the U.S. is trying to negotiate some deals with countries in the region, whether it's Pakistan or Tajikistan, to try to install a presence that will make those kinds of operations more possible, but it doesn't have that presence right now.
So is it clear whether the U.S. will target when Washington has intel on a plot underway? And or will drones target ISIS-K, for example, even if they're in a rural part of Afghanistan with no clear intention of staging an attack?
One of the, I guess, questions we're going to have is how we'll ascertain either way. So again, if we don't have really a network of informants in Afghanistan and we don't have a stable central government that's an ally, I would imagine there will be a CIA presence that's left behind. But even still, having that intelligence, actionable intelligence, will be a real challenge, I think. But let's say there is some evidence that there's a plot. I would imagine that there will be a real inclination to try to conduct counterterrorism strikes against those targets.
Reports from the ground say that the U.S. drone operation in Afghanistan over the weekend killed 10 civilians, and a major criticism of U.S. drones in the past has been civilian casualties. Do you think we might see a rise in civilian losses in Afghanistan from an increase in U.S. drone strikes?
Those kinds of civilian casualties will be more likely because we just won't have the eyes and ears on the ground that we need to inform a more accurate drone strike. And so this happened for years, especially in the kind of early 2010s, where there was a high number of civilian casualties and a lot of indication that actually led to more terrorism and more terrorists.
So now with the Taliban in charge in Afghanistan, how do you see them handling this likely new phase of drone warfare in Afghanistan? Won't they have to give a green light for U.S. drones to fly in their airspace?
Well, there is precedent for the U.S. conducting these drone strikes without being green lit by the host government. And in fact, if the U.S. and the host government were simpatico, if they saw things eye to eye, we probably wouldn't be needing to do drone strikes in the first place. So it was always kind of an awkward situation with the Pakistani government, where publicly they said they did not endorse these strikes, but it seemed as though there was some tacit sort of understanding that they had given the green light.
Meantime, the U.S. is reportedly about to announce a revised playbook on drone warfare for counterterrorism. Any idea, Sarah, what this might look like and how it will affect possible drone warfare in Afghanistan?
Well, what happened toward the end of the Obama administration, the number of civilian casualties from these drone strikes really kind of crept up. They made the rules of engagement on this more stringent so that there had to be near certainty that there would not be civilian casualties. And I think what will happen is there will be an effort on the part of the Biden administration to rein that back in.
I mean, the U.S. has been using drones in combat for years now. How effective have they been in countering threats like Al-Qaeda and now ISIS-K?
So if the U.S. has identified an individual who is linked to a terrorist plot, drones are quite effective at eliminating that target and often can do so without a lot of casualties. I think the concern is that may be short term, that there are these real consequences, the kind of blowback question as the U.S. continues to do this, that the local populations harbor a lot of antipathy toward this sort of behavior. So there has to be a strategy. Drones is more kind of a tactic to address a target without there really being a long-term strategy. But you can see kind of politically, again, domestically, internationally, this can be very effective because the Biden administration can rightfully claim that we don't have troops on the ground anymore.
Well, to that point, Sarah, you've heard the rhetoric of how the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is an end to the forever wars. Can you say legitimately it is the end if drones continue to do the job there?
It's sort of a convenient rhetorical ploy in the sense that we don't have boots on the ground. And what I've seen in my research is that Americans tend to be more divorced from the action. I mean, we saw this over the weekend that once 13 American soldiers and Marines were killed, suddenly people are paying attention. And once we can kind of create that distance, which drones create, these wars will continue. They just won't be called forever wars because U.S. personnel aren't being killed.
Sarah Krebs is a national security expert at the Brookings Institute. She's been speaking with us from Washington. Sarah, thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you very much.
What happens when an entire country loses access to Twitter? That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Millions of people used to use Twitter in Nigeria, but that stopped after the government cut off access to the site nearly 3 months ago. Last month, officials in Abuja, the capital, said they might bring Twitter back soon, but Nigerians are still waiting and feeling the impact. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gakandi has our story.
It all started in June with a tweet from Nigeria's president, Muhammadu Buhari. He was responding to Nigerian separatists in the country, and Buhari said he would deal with them, quote, in a language they understand. Boya Adegoke is with the digital rights group Paradigm Initiative in Abuja. He says most Nigerians understood very well what the president meant.
A lot of Nigerians were not comfortable with because we felt that it was targeting a set of people in Nigeria, a particular ethnic group.
That ethnic group is the Igbo people of the Biafra region. Twitter deleted the president's tweet, citing violations of its policy on threats or incitement. Nigeria's government responded by suspending Twitter indefinitely. Minister of Foreign Affairs Geoffrey Onyema explained why during a press conference.
When you have that kind of power to manage and facilitate the communication of billions of people around the world, it has to come with responsibilities.
I reached out to the special media assistant to Nigeria's president. He told me that this is an issue of stability and that Nigerian separatists are using Twitter to cause chaos. Regardless, the suspension is also seen as an attack on freedom of speech. Local NGOs are going to court over the issue. Digital rights activist Boya Adegoke says the government is hostile towards social media in general.
They are not really very comfortable with that space. They are not comfortable with the fact that it's a space that they don't have the kind of control, influence they have over, you know, traditional media.
Many Nigerians have used Twitter to express their frustration with the government and sometimes to organize protests. But the suspension is having an impact in other ways, too, says Ada Anyagwa. She's a 29-year-old food vendor in Lagos.
It requires a lot of money to set up business, a physical store in Lagos especially. So I've been doing my business online, on social media.
Anyagwa has more than 7,000 followers on Twitter. She says the platform helps her attract customers. Now she estimates she's lost 70% of them because of the suspension.
Since the ban, patronage has been low, like significantly low, because a lot of other people are not using Twitter VPN.
VPN, or virtual private network, is what people use in order to get around the suspension. But VPNs are expensive, says Kehinde Alaba. A 30-year-old sells rabbit, goat, and snail meat online in Lagos.
The expensive part of it is it consumes data a lot. Most times, it's some data that could have lasted you a month, if it lasts you 2 weeks or 1 week.
But Alaba says the extra data costs for accessing the platform are still worth it.
We still keep on using Twitter, no matter what, because it's my sole source of income.
His message to the government is this: please, we beg you, bring back Twitter. There are signs that could happen soon. Nigeria says Twitter has met most of the conditions they've set for restoring the platform. In an email, a Twitter spokesperson says the company is working on a path forward. For The World, I'm Halima Gakandi.
For the last 400 years, you would be hard-pressed to find a wild beaver in Britain. The species was hunted to extinction by the end of the 16th century. Conservation groups in the UK, though, have been wanting to turn back time and reintroduce beavers to their native lands. The government is considering plans to release beavers into rivers there after a successful pilot project. To discuss, I'm joined by Chris Jones, director of the UK's Beaver Trust. So, Chris, what most people know about beavers is that they cut down trees to build big, complex dams. Why bring them back?
Wow. It's a huge question, really. Our rivers are not in great health. In fact, cannot be in great health without this animal. We need this. You know, our hydrological cycle is incredibly important. So where you get beavers, you begin to get large, slow-moving bodies of water. They hold a lot of water during drought events. Our land in the Northern Hemisphere, you know, it's the same applies in North America, has been dried out by the removal of this animal. We need to hold water on our land for longer. You know, if you live in a settlement which is by a stream, if you haven't got flooding yet, you're probably going to, as our weather extremes become greater, the swings get stronger. And if you live in a place which is a little bit prone to drought, then those droughts are going to get worse, and it's going to be really important to have beavers in upstream areas.
So you've spoken about the benefits that beavers bring, but they have not been around for 400 years, and ecosystems have changed in their absence. Could a reintroduction project spin out of control?
If we think about beavers, what do? They cut down trees and they create localized flooding. That's what happens when they build a dam. Now, if that localized flooding is in a place where it does not matter, then we can say that as being a societal benefit. You know, because the biodiversity will improve, the fish will improve, the birds will improve, all those sorts of things. Plus, we will help to reduce the risk of downstream flooding. So that's all good. If they create a flood which floods your house because you live next to the river, that is a bad. I think, you know, we've got the benefit of starting with a completely blank slate now. We can select those places where we bring beavers, where they're going to have the maximum in terms of, let's say, societal benefits. We can manage those animals in such a way that we maximize the goods and minimize the bads.
You have hosted a family of beavers in an enclosure on your own land. What's that been like?
It is absolutely extraordinary. They've created a large area of water, which was not there before, or maybe was only there 1,000 years ago. They've brought back 8 different species of birds have turned up. We've got 11 species of bats feeding here. In a time of drought in 2018, we could actually pump water out onto our surrounding land because the beavers created a reserve of water for us. That is, if you're interested in preventing flooding downstream, that is the name of the game.
How does their dam look today? Pretty solid?
Oh, it's amazing. You can just walk across it. I use that area of land to graze some of my cows on, and they just walk across the top of the dams. It's quite extraordinary how solid they are.
I mean, the beaver has a reputation as this industrious little worker, certainly the case here in the U.S., where we have plenty of them. In Canada, they're revered, of course, even appears on the Canadian nickel. So after 400 years of not having any beavers, what is the cultural connection Brits have with beavers today?
It's kind of being relearned, you know. I think we do have that cultural connection is still, but it's kind of through the prism of North America. You know, we lost our beavers a long time ago. And I think, yes, the last ones were 400 years. I think the vast majority of our beavers were gone maybe 1,000 years ago. But we're slowly relearning it, you know. We get a lot of school kids come and visit our site, for example, and they see the beavers and they see them making stuff and they see them cutting down stuff. And I think they begin to learn that, yeah, these animals have a real impact. You know, that they really, really move stuff.
Chris Jones, the director and founder of the UK's Beaver Trust. He's been speaking with us from Cornwall. Chris, thank you very much.
Hey, you're really welcome, Marco. Good luck out there.
More stories from around the globe are coming up. You're with the world. American allies in the Middle East worried with what they're seeing in Afghanistan.
America, one day is in, one day is out.
One day in, one day out is a big concern for Iraqi Kurds. They consider the U.S. their protector.
We are watching what's happening in Afghanistan, but we hope that the situation in the two countries are different.
That and Mr. Zelensky goes to Washington, finally, on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. President Biden says America's war in Afghanistan is over, but the fight against terrorism will continue. One battlefield in that global conflict is in the Philippines. With U.S. help, local forces there are fighting Islamist rebels who refuse to give up. As the world's Patrick Wynn reports, the rebels' latest tactic is especially startling.
One of the most vicious battles fought in Southeast Asia this century happened just a few years ago, the Battle of Marawi in the southern Philippines. Islamist rebels took over a whole city, and Filipino troops fought block by block to get it back, while America supplied intelligence, guns, and drones. It dragged on for months, turning the city into rubble. That was 2017. The rebels retreated to the jungle to fight another day, and most journalists drifted away too. But not Criselda Yabes, author of The Battle of Marawi. She stuck with the story, kept talking to soldiers there fighting the insurgents. And these soldiers, they kept seeing something out in the jungle that left them pretty shaken up.
A lot of them had stories about how they first had to fight with child warriors.
child warriors, like 10 to 13 years old.
The rebels had put the kids on the front line first as a strategy.
If that was meant to shock Filipino soldiers, it worked.
It was really a big dilemma because were they going to kill them, right, seeing children, or will they let the kids kill them first?
Criselda Yabes was also surprised by this, but maybe not quite as much as soldiers brought in from other parts of the country, because she spent some years growing up in that area, in Sulu, a string of islands in this crystal blue sea that also happens to be a hotbed for radicalism.
This is a place where everybody has a gun in every household. Even kids who are as young as 5 would be taught how to use a gun, and that's normal for them. It's like having a kettle in the kitchen.
More recently, something happened that really did shake her up. The detention in June of a little girl named Aisha, only 12 years old. She was discovered by the army during a raid on a rebel hideout in Sulu. Aisha seemed to be, in some ways, like lots of kids, addicted to her phone and really into TikTok. But she was, in other ways, very different.
She was really indoctrinated into thinking that your objective in life is to kill as many soldiers as possible. And she calls them pigs, she calls them dogs. It's a question of black and white. Soldiers are bad, rebels are good.
And not just any rebels. She's talking about Abu Sayyaf. Aisha belonged to the group, known for kidnapping, extortion, and even beheading captives. That is one of Abu Sayyaf's online videos. It's been around for decades, getting started with seed capital from Osama bin Laden himself. But more recently, the group pledged allegiance to ISIS. Abu Sayyaf hoped to turn the city of Marwawi into a tropical outpost for ISIS. Now, Aisha showed up after that battle once Abu Sayyaf melted into the wilderness. She's actually from Indonesia. Her father wanted to join ISIS, but ended up joining Abu Sayyaf, the next best thing. He moved the family to Sulu, to the jungle. And that's where Aisha's dad, according to Yabes, made a decision.
1 week after she arrived, the father tells her, you know, we're going to have to be suicide bombers, and that's it, as if it's just a normal thing.
In 2019, Aisha's father and mother did pull off a suicide bombing, blowing themselves up in a Catholic church in the Philippines. And suddenly, Aisha and her older sister were orphans, stuck with Abu Sayyaf.
In the hands of strangers. I mean, it's not as if they knew people from Sulu all these years. It's not like that. You know, these were strangers. These were people they didn't know, even if they were supposedly fighting for the same cause.
Aisha was forced to marry a 16-year-old boy who Yabe says she didn't really like. She spent most of her time hanging around the wives of other rebels, playing on her phone, just trying to be a kid.
She's, well, of course, tiny, petite. You know, she's still at that age where she's having a crush on boys and or listening to music, watching movies on her cell phone, things like that.
But Aisha also joined raids on army encampments. That's what she told the army after they found her and her sister. Aisha claimed to have been in more than a dozen firefights and even killed 3 soldiers. I asked Criselda Yabes if Aisha was maybe exaggerating, and she told me, yeah, at first, she wondered that too.
But when I spoke to one officer, he seemed to have believed it.
There is a photo of Aisha in the forest with an M16, which looks huge in her tiny hands. And during questioning, she did seem to know a lot about guns.
One officer made her load and assemble a rifle, and she was able to do it.
As for Aisha's whereabouts now, the government isn't saying much, but she and her sister are in custody somewhere. Their story may be unusual, but it shows the extremes that groups like Abu Sayyaf will go to keep fighting. America is much less directly involved in this conflict compared to Afghanistan, but this one isn't over. And Yabe says it won't end soon. She says the U.S. and the Philippines are fooling themselves if they think there's a military solution here.
Why is it still, okay, how many rebels have been killed? And they know, all these years, they know that that's not the answer to the problem. They know that.
If that sounds pessimistic, well, so does the most recent U.S. Defense Department report on this conflict in the southern Philippines. It says American efforts there in recent years, quote, do not appear to have made a substantial difference. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Head to the outskirts of Erbil in northern Iraq, and you'll find nice houses with manicured lawns inside gated communities, communities that are named after the strongest allies of the Kurdish people in this part of Iraq, the French village, the Italian, the British. The American village is the fanciest of these suburbs. That's symbolic of the importance that Kurds have placed on their relationship with the U.S. Now, with American forces out of Afghanistan, Kurds are concerned about whether the U.S. might withdraw support for them in Iraq. As Rebecca Collard reports from Erbil, they may be turning elsewhere for protection.
At a Tex-Mex restaurant inside the American village, Mabas Zaman, like so many Kurds, is quick to sing America's praises.
I love America so much, and it's a great country.
In July, President Joe Biden announced that the U.S. is ending its combat mission in Iraq. That's leaving the Kurds, who have arguably been Washington's most devoted ally, physically and politically vulnerable.
My life and our life will be in danger if the Americans pulled out from here.
Iraq and Afghanistan are different in many, many ways, but there are similarities. The U.S. invaded both countries after 9/11. Then, in both cases, the U.S. installed theoretically democratic governments and spent trillions of dollars training and equipping their armies. The last weeks have made it clear that didn't work in Afghanistan, and so far it hasn't really worked in Iraq either. When ISIS made its rampage across Iraq in 2014, thousands of Iraqi troops fled, tossing their uniforms and leaving their American-made weapons to ISIS. Sounds familiar. Fala Mustafa Bakir is a senior foreign policy advisor to Nechevan Barzani, the president of the Kurdish region of Iraq.
Yes, we are watching what's happening in Afghanistan, but we hope that the situation in the two countries are different.
Bakir doesn't think the U.S. will abandon the Kurds of Iraq, despite what happened in neighboring Syria. After fighting alongside the U.S., the Kurds of Syria felt abandoned once the job was done and the U.S. announced it was leaving. Washington's NATO ally, Turkey, pushed the Kurds out of the area. But Bakir does say,
if there is withdrawal of U.S. forces, there would be spheres of influence by the regional powers which are here. They will try to increase their influence, and this is not in the interest of Iraq.
In January, a slickly produced Iranian short film started making the rounds on social media. It's a dramatization of Iran saving the Kurds in 2014 as ISIS militants approached Erbil. In this scene, Masoud Barzani, then Kurdish president, is panicking. He can't reach U.S. officials. The film caused a stir because of its liberal depiction of history, but the message was clear. Tehran will save you, not Washington.
Yeah, well, this is part of the Iranian propaganda, but it shows you their way of thinking. They have been much smarter than the Americans, their role in Iraq.
That's Hiwa Osman, a Kurdish analyst and former advisor to Iraq's president. He says with the U.S. leaving, better relations with Iran are now crucial for the Kurds.
America, one day is in, one day is out. One day it says fighting force, the other time it says advisors and trainers. Uh-huh. You know, nobody knows. So if you were an Iraqi, who would you bank on to be an ally with?
Earlier this month, the current president of the Kurdish region, Nechevan Barzani, traveled to Iran for the inauguration of Iran's new president, Ibrahim Raisi, a man under U.S. sanctions. Barzani and Raisi met and talked about increasing trade and security cooperation. And Barzani went as far as to praise Qasem Soleimani, who was killed by the U.S. in Iraq last year. A statement by the Iranian president after said the Kurdish president emphasized that the Kurds are part of Iran and the Islamic Revolution. Back at the Tex-Mex restaurant, Zaman dismisses the idea that another ally could take America's place, though he does say he was disappointed when the U.S. didn't support the Kurds' sovereignty bid in 2017.
I was believing that the first country will recognize that it will be America.
Zaman's confusion seems to mirror the larger Kurdish political consciousness.
Made in Iran.
Outside the restaurant, there are empty munitions boxes decoratively stacked. Some appear to be American-made, but others are from Iranian-made mortar shells. Zeman doesn't know why they're there. When I ask what exactly he thinks the U.S. has done for the Kurds, he hesitates and then he changes his tune.
The reality is they got advantage of the Kurds, but the Kurds haven't got any advantage of them. That's the bitter reality. That America, they are here because their interest is here. And this is not for everyone. Everybody knows that. But I still love them because they are a great nation.
For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard, Erbil.
A massive public health emergency is gripping North America. There is a pandemic, but I'm actually talking about the rise in fatal drug overdoses. The U.S. has seen more overdoses from illegal drugs this year than ever before. Canada is also seeing the increase. In the province of British Columbia, the crisis prompted an unusual and untested response, prescribing drugs like opioids to people, drugs that they'd normally get on the streets. The World's Alana Gordon reports on how that's going.
Overdose deaths have plagued British Columbia for a long time. A lot of it has to do with the quality of the street drugs. So much so that Vancouver's health system sends text alerts when they test drugs like heroin or cocaine and find other things in it.
Light green counterfeit Xanax bar tested positive for fentanyl. Check your drugs. Colorless crystals sold as MDMA test positive for xylazine, an animal tranquilizer.
Over time, the drugs have become more and more toxic.
White shiny pebbles thought to be crack cocaine tested positive for fentanyl.
And there will even be bus ads, eh? Like on bus stops and things.
Dr. Matthew Chow is a child psychiatrist in the suburbs of Vancouver.
You know, I'll walk down the street to go buy some milk or something, and there's a big ad to actually say, oh, warning, this week, this is the stuff that we're finding in the drug supply. So, I mean, we are pulling out all the stops to try to save lives here.
Chow has lost several patients to overdoses. Across the province, thousands have died in recent years. So along with those very public warnings, they made the overdose-reversing drug naloxone widely available. They started getting good at keeping more people alive. Deaths finally began to dip. Then COVID hit. Cheyenne Johnson directs the BC Center on Substance Use.
Any gains around those deaths are reversed.
People were told to stay home, to socially distance. Health services closed or went remote. It all created an even deadlier cocktail for people who use drugs, who struggle with addiction. So early on in the pandemic, British Columbia decided to try something out of the box. They developed a policy they call Safe Supply that had never been tried before, that made it easier for doctors and nurses to prescribe people who use street drugs the pharmaceutical equivalents.
So it's meant to protect people from transmitting COVID, from helping them to self-isolate and quarantine, and to help alleviate and manage their withdrawal symptoms and cravings.
Johnson helped develop the guidelines, including how to assess when this is appropriate or not. Henry Fester was one of the early participants.
I started to get my life back to the point that this is what it used to be like before I lost control, you know.
I spoke with him in the spring of 2020. He was able to stop in a pharmacy to pick up his supply of pills. Fester, who's 61, said it was a total relief, a weight lifted, because he didn't have to spend most of his waking hours figuring out what he'd have to do to get his next hit.
I'm so lucky to have what I have. It's given me time to reflect on what life is all about.
In the year and a half since then, about 6,500 people have taken part in this Safe Supply program. Overall, though, overdose deaths still appear to be going up.
I want to acknowledge the losses, the sons and daughters, mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, friends, leaders, elders, who have lost their lives to this toxic drug supply, despite all the work that's been done.
Dr. Shannon McDonald is Chief Medical Officer for BC's First Nations Health Authority. This summer, she and other regional leaders announced they're expanding the Safe Supply program and pouring a lot more resources into it, developing outreach teams and making this a standard intervention that's widely available. But that's going to be challenging. Even supporters of the program, like Henry Fester's doctor, Mark Tyndall, are skeptical that other health providers will come on board.
Physicians are still fairly reluctant to use these guidelines because they haven't you know, been endorsed by the colleges and things, and physicians still feel that they're under quite a bit of surveillance and quite a bit of restrictions, and most have chosen just not to do it.
And then Tyndall says the prescriptions haven't worked for everyone, either because of the amount prescribed or the kind of drug.
It was an experiment, and for some people said that it did help them, but for most people, it wasn't an adequate substitute.
Others worry this could create easier access to addictive pills. As for Henry Fester.
Hello.
Hello, Elena.
Hi. I was finally able to connect with him a year and a half later. He's been isolated and lonely during the pandemic. He says it's been hard to even get out of bed.
You get inside your brain and it kind of takes control, you know, and I don't know, it's so easy. It's so easy to fall into that big black hole, and it's so difficult to crawl out of, like real difficult to crawl out of.
Fester wasn't aware that BC was expanding the Safe Supply program. When I told him, his mood appeared to shift. He's still participating in it.
Oh, I think it's great. I think it's beyond great.
Fester thinks for sure it'll save lives, because even in this pit of COVID darkness, he says he's grateful that at least he doesn't have to take to the streets to find drugs. For the world, I'm Alana Gordon.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is in Washington today for a White House meeting with President Biden. It's a meeting at least 2 years in the making. Zelensky was planning on sitting down with former President Trump. That was derailed, of course, by the impeachment scandal, a scandal tied precisely to a phone call between Trump and Zelensky when Trump asked Zelensky to investigate Joe Biden. Now, with Biden in office, officials in both countries are looking for a relationship reset. William Taylor is the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. And Ambassador, you were a key witness in President Trump's impeachment trial. What does a reset look like after an incredibly strange 4 years in the Ukraine-U.S. relationship?
Marco, you're right. It was a strange 4 years, but I wouldn't use the word reset for all kinds of reasons. And I say that because the relationship between the United States and Ukraine over the past 20 years has been solid, has been consistent. So it's not really reset, it's a reassurance that the support for Ukraine continues.
So going back to a pre-2016 state of affairs, what will Zelensky be looking then to get out of this meeting?
He'll want to make the case that Ukraine is standing on its own. It is a democracy, it's a proud democracy. It's an independent country, it's proud of its independence. It now, of course, has to defend its independence from the Russians who have invaded and occupied parts of Ukraine. So President Zelensky wants to demonstrate that Ukraine is standing on its own and is a worthy partner.
So one of the main points of tension in this meeting between Biden and Zelensky will certainly be Nord Stream 2, the pipeline project between Russia and Germany, which circumvents Ukraine by way of the Baltic Sea. Where does the U.S. stand on Nord Stream 2?
Where the United States stand is in several places. That is, the Congress has been very clear. Congress adamantly opposes Nord Stream 2 for all the reasons that you just said. It is a challenge to Ukrainian security. It's a challenge to European energy security. And therefore, it's a challenge to us. So the Congress is united against Nord Stream. There was a debate within the administration, I understand. And the administration's policy now is to waive the sanctions that Congress said should be imposed on the people, the companies who are building Nord Stream. The Nord Stream benefits go not really to Germany. I mean, it was Germany that was probably uppermost on the administration's mind when they made that decision. But the real benefits go to Russia. And again, if our worry is a challenge that Russia poses, then Nord Stream helps the Russians and doesn't help us.
I mean, since it is a challenge to Ukrainian security, this pipeline, why would Ukraine now see the U.S. as a reliable partner since the U.S. did not step in on Nord Stream 2?
There are many aspects, of course, to any relationship between any two countries. And allies and strategic partners, in this case, can certainly disagree on things. And Ukraine and the Biden administration disagree on Nord Stream.
Yeah, but disagree on something as existential as national energy supplies?
I would not put existential in that sentence. Nord Stream's important. There's no doubt. That's not existential. It's a couple of billion a year in revenues for Ukraine. But it is also, as you point out, it does give the Russians longer-term leverage over Europe and over Ukraine. But existential is too strong. It's important, but existential is the Russian challenge to Ukraine.
So let's go there. The war between Russia and Ukraine has been going on since Russia annexed Crimea. That was 2014. What concrete steps do you think Biden and Zelensky can take coming out of this meeting to help end that conflict? Or does Russia hold all the cards here at the end of the day?
Russia does not hold all cards at the end of the day. And there are steps that I am sure that President Zelensky and President Biden will talk about. One of the questions that President Zelensky is going to ask President Biden is, will you get involved? Will you help us negotiate the Russians out of our country, out of Ukraine? And I hope that President Biden will say yes and will engage and bring the weight of the United States diplomatic efforts to those negotiations to try to negotiate an end to that conflict on Ukrainian terms.
One of the big things, of course, that Russia is suspicious of with Ukraine is Ukraine's desire to join NATO. Should Ukraine be fast-tracked into NATO?
Ukraine should not necessarily be fast-tracked into NATO. And I think the Ukrainians know that they're not looking for a shortcut by any means. What they are looking for is a reaffirmation of the promise made to Ukraine and Georgia, by the way, in 2008 at a NATO summit. They said that Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO. That was a promise made in 2008. And so I think the Ukrainians today want to hear some reassurance that that promise is still there and some expectation of how to realize that promise. So this is an important goal.
If Ukraine were fast-tracked into NATO, what do you think the optics of that would do to Russia? How would they react?
I guess it's an interesting question. It's not really a relevant question, however. The Russians don't have a veto here. The Russians don't get to choose, don't get to decide, don't get a say in whether a country joins NATO or not. They'll not be happy. They probably weren't happy when Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania joined NATO. Those are right on their borders as well. But that's not decisive by any means.
Ambassador, listeners will remember you as one of the key people testifying in former President Trump's first impeachment trial because you were at the time ambassador to Ukraine. It was a moment where Ukraine felt that it could not necessarily rely on the U.S. because at the end of the day, the U.S. is focused on itself. What do you think the U.S. has done to change this perception?
So the visit this week of President Zelensky goes a long way to demonstrating to Ukraine the closeness of this relationship. When you look at all of the agreements across the government for cooperation and collaboration, this demonstrates that the United States is a strong supporter of Ukraine. It demonstrates that there is a commitment on the part of the United States to a successful Ukraine, economically, politically, democratically, and from a security standpoint. So I think this meeting, which, as you say, is a long time coming, is more than just a sit down for an hour in the Oval Office. It is a demonstration of a strong connection, support, and partnership going both ways. I want to emphasize the both way part because Ukraine brings a lot to the table, but the strong partnership between the United States and Ukraine.
William Taylor, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine and the vice president of strategic stability and security at the United States Institute of Peace. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you, Marco. Good talking to you.
You always know you can hear the voices at the center of the story on the world. Follow us on Instagram to see some of the people and places behind those voices. Right now on our page, you can check out photos of back-to-school season around the globe, new clothes, new friends, and masks. That's at theworld.org/Instagram. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
From PRX.